You're listening to the Sermon Podcast of The Church of Christ on McDermott Road in Plano, Texas. Our mission is to help people become more like Jesus. To learn more about our church family or to join us for worship, go to ccmcdermott.org. And now, the latest lesson.
Good morning, McDermott Road. As always, I love you and I appreciate you. If you haven't been with us right now, our current sermon series is a series on family. Regardless of how big or how small your family is, families come in all shapes and sizes, and this series is for everyone from Mother's Day to Father's Day. Our advice is simple. Don't freak out. No matter what happens, don't freak out. And I know I say that because I need that advice more than anybody, but I also know that it's easier said than done sometimes, isn't it? It's easier said than done when our family does things that it frustrates us or disappoints us. But what about when our family does things that doesn't just disappoint us, it disappoints God? What about when our family sins? And as I thought about that subject all week this week, I thought about the fact that I've been on both sides of that, and probably you have as well. I've been on the side of it where I've been the family member who has been sinning, and on the side of it where I have had a family member who has been sinning, and I'm frustrated with what's happening. But the thing about it is that when we freak out, when we lose our patience, when we lose our cool, when we panic, when we're outraged, it almost never makes it better. It almost always makes it worse, doesn't it? So what do we do? What do we do? What do we do when a parent finds out that their child is using profanity or pornography, or that their child is using alcohol or using drugs? What does a spouse do when a spouse finds a sinful secret? What does a son or daughter do when they're frustrated about the sins of their parents? What do we do when a family member does something that they're not just sinning against God, but they're sinning against someone else? They're lying or they're stealing or they're hurting someone. How can we possibly remain calm in a situation like that? Even if we know that our calmness will help the situation, how do we remain calm? What do we do, and how do we navigate situations in our own families when someone is doing something sinful? And we want to be outraged and we're afraid. I want to listen to the words of Jesus this morning because I think the words of Jesus will help us to navigate these kinds of situations. But before we get to Jesus, I want to look at the background, because the Old Testament, the books we call the Old Testament, the Law of Moses, this is the background for why Jesus said what he said. Because Jesus isn't really, a lot of times, teaching anything new. He's simply interpreting and applying the law for his followers to say, this is what this really looks like when God's people live this out. And the people of Israel, the Jewish people, they were a family, a big, huge family. And the Law of Moses was not just for like the big national stuff that happened, but also for the everyday family situations that they found themselves in, situations much like we find ourselves in. So if you have your Bible, we're going to start in maybe an unexpected place, Leviticus chapter 19 and verse 16. Here's what the Law of Moses said to the family of Israel. It said, you shall not go around as a, what's that next word? A slanderer. We'll talk about that in a second. You shall not go around as a slanderer among your people, and you shall not stand up against the life of your neighbor. I am the Lord. This is what God is saying to the people of Israel. You shall not go around as a slanderer. Now, the word slanderer means a person who spreads damaging information about another person. Damaging information about another person. Notice, it's not about whether or not it's true or false. Sometimes when we gossip about people, we say, well, it's true. It doesn't make any difference. You can still slander somebody, even if the information you are saying about them is true. So even if somebody sins against you, whether it's somebody in your family, whether it's a neighbor, whether it's a coworker, We want to sometimes tell other people about it, don't we? We could talk about that motivation. Why is it that we want to go and tell other people about, can you believe what this person did? But God tells his people, when these kinds of things happen and somebody does something that they're not supposed to do, don't be a slanderer. And then this next phrase, you shall not stand up against the life of your neighbor. Now, what that means exactly might be a little bit hard to determine, but I think we can all attest to the fact that you can ruin someone's life. You can destroy their life with just your words. A testimony about someone that said, this guy did this thing or this lady did this thing. It might be a false accusation and it might end up them being put to death for the crime that you said they did. And maybe they didn't even do that. But even if they don't literally die, your words could still destroy their life. And sometimes we don't think about that, do we? Sometimes when we're so mad and we're so upset and we're outraged and we're afraid and something happened or we think something happened or something happened to us or something happened in our family, we just want to get even. We want other people to feel what we're feeling. And so we use our words as weapons, forgetting that we could actually destroy someone's life with our slander. And so God tells his people, when these kinds of things happen, because they will, people will do things that they shouldn't do, or you will think someone did something that they didn't actually do. But these kinds of conflicts, these kinds of relationship problems are going to happen. And when they do, don't go around as a slanderer. Don't stand up against the life of your neighbor. Be very careful what you say, when you say it, and how you say it. He goes on, verse 17, you shall not hate your brother in your what, church? In your heart. You shall not hate your brother in your heart, but you shall reason frankly with your neighbor, lest you incur sin because of him. You shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against the sons of your own people, but you shall love your neighbor. You recognize those words, don't you? You shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. So already we've seen three things that they weren't supposed to do when they have these kinds of conflicts. Three things they're not supposed to do. One, don't gossip and slander. Whether it's true or not, don't destroy someone's reputation with your words. Don't go around spreading, you know what this guy did, you know what she did, you know what my aunt did, you know what my cousin did, you know what my daughter did, you know what my parents did. Don't gossip and slander. Number two, don't take vengeance. Don't try to hurt them the way they hurt you. The goal is not to get even. The goal is not for them to feel the pain that you've felt. It's going to be your natural inclination, isn't it? To try to make them feel what you felt. Don't take vengeance and don't bear a grudge. Don't hate them in your heart. Don't hate them in your heart. All of these things come incredibly naturally, don't they? It comes incredibly naturally when you feel wronged, or even when you just know someone did something wrong, even if they didn't do it to you, you feel it, you're afraid, you're angry, you're upset, and your inclination is the same thing as it was thousands of years ago. You're going to want to talk about it to somebody. And maybe it's so that you can get even with them. And even if you don't talk about it, you're going to have this tendency to harbor that hatred, that bitterness, that grudge in your heart. And God says to his people, don't do these things. Instead, here's what you are to do. They were supposed to, my translation says, reason frankly. Other translations say things like reprove or rebuke or confront them directly. Confront them directly. Have an honest conversation with them about what they've done. Now, that's a novel idea, isn't it? somebody did something wrong, or you think someone did something wrong, or you heard someone did something wrong, or you suspect someone did something wrong, and instead of talking to your friends about it, instead of getting a group together to chat about it, see what we should do, and bless their heart, I heard they did this thing. Instead of any of that, go directly to them and have a frank conversation with them, an honest conversation with them, a direct conversation with them. Find out what really happened and tell them why you're concerned and what this has done. Have that conversation directly with them. In fact, this passage ends by saying, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I mean, that's what you would want other people to do to you, isn't it? That's what you would want other people to do for you, isn't it? Somebody suspects that you did something wrong. You wouldn't want them going to talk to their cousins and their aunts and their uncles and their kids and their parents. You would want them coming to you and saying, I'm concerned. I love you. See, that's what it all comes down to, isn't it? Is love your neighbor. And it's really hard, if not impossible, to love your neighbor when you freak out. At least I'm not very good at loving my family when I panic. When I allow my outrage and my fear to get the best of me, I'm not thinking clearly. And when I'm not thinking clearly, I'm not talking clearly. I'm not having clear, honest, frank conversations. And my panic doesn't make the situation better. It almost always makes it worse. And so all the way back in the law of Moses, God's people were told, listen, you are going to have conflicts and people are going to do things that they shouldn't do. And when they do, don't slander them. Don't have a grudge against them. Don't keep this bitterness in your heart towards them. And don't take vengeance on them. Go have an honest conversation with them first. Love your neighbor as yourself. Do for them what you would want someone else to do for you. Now, doesn't this sound a lot like what Jesus was saying? Let's look first at the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5 and verse 21. So again, Jesus is interpreting and applying the law for his followers, which includes, by the way, you and me. Like, this is what our king, our teacher, our rabbi tells us to do when you have conflict. This is the kind of thing that you ought to do. This is how you ought to solve it. Jesus says, verse 21, you have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council, and whoever says, you fool, will be liable to the hell of fire. I mean, throughout the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus has this tendency to say, you have heard that it was said, but I say to you. Now, this is true. You've heard that it was said, you shall not murder. But I think people might have been patting themselves on the back, saying, see, I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. I didn't kill nobody. You know, I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. I'm a good guy. I'm keeping the law. I'm not a murderer. And Jesus says, yes. But that's not everything the law said for you to do. That's not the extent of it. That wasn't the extent for Israel. It's not the extent for you and me. Just because you didn't kill them, you wanted to and you didn't, good job. Keep doing that. Don't kill people. But that's not the extent of how you deal with conflict in your relationships. That's not the extent of it. Because he goes on and he says, you shouldn't even be angry or insult them or say, you fool. But this is what happens, isn't it? When we're outraged by somebody's behavior. I mean, we even call it righteous indignation. Like, I'm mad and my anger is righteous because they're bad and they did something sinful and they're wrong and I keep telling them to stop it and don't do that and they keep doing this thing and now I'm angry. And this is our tendency, isn't it? To insult, to slander. And why do we call somebody, you empty-headed person, you fool? Why do we do that? We want to embarrass them, don't we? We want to humiliate them. We want them to feel the pain of what they've done. And we think it's our place to punish them for being so ridiculous and doing something so ridiculous. And even though these are the words of Jesus, how often are words like he is condemning here? How often are these things heard even in Christian homes? Christian spouses saying these kinds of things to one another. I always tell my kids, there's a difference between arguing and fighting. In an argument, you're trying to reach a solution. You're trying to work things out. You're trying to decide who's right and who's wrong and what we should do next. And I don't think there's anything wrong with arguing most of the time. What's wrong is fighting. See, in a fight, your goal is to hurt somebody. And we do that with our words all the time, don't we? Even in Christian households, even Christian spouses, people who say, I believe Jesus is the King, the Christ, the Son of the living God. I follow him. But we look at our spouse, and because of what our spouse did, and we don't like what they did, and maybe even what they did was sinful and wrong, we look at them and we say, you fool. Or maybe even something much worse. And Jesus says, it's not just don't murder people. Be careful of your words, because your words can destroy lives too. Christian spouses, Christian parents talking this way to their children. Christian children who are supposed to love and respect and honor their parents talking this way to their parents. Or even harboring these thoughts in our hearts. Jesus says it starts. The problem starts long before you kill somebody. The problem starts here. When you're not loving them in your heart. And you're not speaking well of them. He goes on, verse 23. So, if you're offering your gift at the altar. And you might think, at the time, there's nothing more important than that, right? You might think, Jesus is the Son of God, and he would say, worship is most important. You might say, worship is most important. That's not what Jesus said. Really? Surely there's nothing in the world more important than going to worship and offering a gift to God. But here's what Jesus says. So if you're offering your gift at the altar, and there you remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. And he says, first be what, church? Reconciled. First be reconciled to your brother and then come and offer your gift. So you might think, nothing in the world more important than going to worship. Nothing more important than offering a gift to God. And Jesus says, there's something that you need to handle first. Reconciliation. That's the goal. That's the goal in all of this, in this entire conversation. Everything that God was telling Israel about how they were to handle their conflicts within the nation of Israel, and everything that Jesus is telling his followers about how to handle conflict in our relationships, all of it is about reconciliation. Jesus says, if you're there, you're at the temple, and you're offering a gift to God, and you remember, I have conflict with my brother or my sister. Now that's these brothers and sisters, right? It's our Christian brothers and sisters. But that also applies to your spouse, probably, your kids, your aunts, your uncles, your cousins, your nieces, your nephews, your grandchildren. And you know there's a problem at home. Worship is important, but so is reconciliation. He says, leave your gift at the altar and first go and be reconciled. This is the goal. This is the goal. Go talk to them. Isn't that what God said in Leviticus in chapter 19? Go have a frank conversation with them. If it's they have a problem with something you've done or you have a problem with something that they've done, go talk it out. Before you offer up some gift to God, go and be reconciled with them. This is always the goal, reconciliation, put things back together, repair, restore, fix. Don't panic. Don't get angry and throw things as I want to do, as we all want to do. Don't say something that's going to ruin someone's life. Go talk to them. Or here's what Jesus says later in the book of Matthew. This is chapter 18 and verse 15. He says this, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. If he listens to you, you have gained your brother. See, Jesus acknowledges sometimes people are going to sin against you. They're going to do things that not only God disapproves of, but are actually against you. And being patient doesn't necessarily mean being passive. It doesn't mean you just have to sit there and take it and don't do anything, don't say anything. Just be patient. Just be calm. Just ignore it. There are times when the best thing that you could possibly do is overlook an offense because it's not a big deal. Like, you don't have to make a federal case out of everything. But there are some times where something needs to be said. And you aren't loving anyone to just passively sit there and take it. Jesus doesn't expect you to say nothing. What he does expect you to do is to be honest, to be frank, to be direct, to talk to the person who did something to sin against you. But again, the goal here is what? If he listens to you, then you have gained your brother. The goal is reconciliation. Restore and repair the relationship. The goal is not revenge. Let's be real. Sometimes when we go and we talk to someone, if we go and talk to someone, we're just doing it so they know how we feel. That's not the goal. The goal isn't just for them to know how you feel or know what you think. The goal is restoration. The goal is to win your brother, win your sister, win your parent, win your spouse. The goal is repair, restore, set right what has gone a different direction. Now, isn't this exactly what God said in Leviticus chapter 19? Go, have this direct conversation. Now, this idea of alone, why does Jesus say go and have this conversation alone? Well, it's so you can clear up any misunderstanding because you might be wrong about what you think they did. It's so that you can clear up any misunderstanding. It's also so that you don't shame them. So you don't publicly humiliate them. Because maybe once they hear what they've done, they say, I had no idea. I didn't even know I did that. I didn't even know I said that. I'm so sorry I said that. Can we repair this? Absolutely. We want to keep this to a minimum so that we're not humiliating people. But if you've already told 20 people about it, you've already gossiped about them, you've already slandered about them, and then finally once they find out about what you've said or what they've done, now how do they make that right? They've been publicly shamed and humiliated for something they would love to put behind them and to fix and repair. And so this is why Jesus says, go first, have this conversation with them. Don't tell anybody else about it. Don't drag their name through the mud. Go have a conversation. I know you're going to want to panic. You're going to be so upset and you're going to want to tell other people about it because you're going to want to punish them. But don't do it. Have this conversation with them directly. Now, I think there's a big caveat that should be said here. I don't know that this situation or that this passage covers every situation, but the point of it is be discreet. And there's wisdom in that always. Be discreet. But I think there are times when it's not wise or right to confront someone alone. Like if somebody has been abused, and going to their abuser alone will put them in a situation where they might be abused again, that's not loving or helpful for you or for the other person. And there are some times when a sin is also a crime. And sometimes the very best, sometimes the only solution is to go to the authorities. I think we need to say that, don't we? But even in a criminal situation, we are still trying to handle things this way, discreetly. We're not trying to take unsubstantiated accusations and slander somebody all over the place. We're trying to prove what's true and what's not true. That's the point here. Let's be discreet about this. Let's be wise about this, but let's be discreet about this And we're not trying to punish people. We're seeking reconciliation. Verse 16, Jesus says, "But if he does not listen, take one or two others along with you, that every charge may be established by the evidence of two or three witnesses. If he refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church. And if he refuses to listen even to the church, let him be to you as a Gentile and a tax collector." What's so refreshing about Jesus is that Jesus is realistic, isn't he? Because he's acknowledging the fact that you go talk to this person and you discreetly say, "This is what happened and we need to fix this." Sometimes they're going to listen and you're going to win your brother. You're going to gain your brother. Everything's going to be put back the way that it should be. And sometimes that's not going to happen. They're going to say, I disagree. You're wrong. I'm not listening to you. I don't want any part of this. I'm not participating in this. And sometimes that's going to happen. And Jesus acknowledges that very real possibility. He knows that some people will respond that way. And again, back to the law of Moses, there was this idea, this standard that you had to have two or three witnesses to establish that something was true. Otherwise, it's just your word against theirs. And again, we're trying to avoid slander. We're trying to avoid ruining someone's reputation. We're trying to establish what is factual, what is true, and not just say, "Well, here's what I think," and then telling everybody and their dog about what you think. We're trying to protect both your reputation and theirs. And he says, but if they won't listen to these witnesses, and it's well established amongst multiple witnesses that this is true, at some point you have to tell the ecclesia, the church. Now, in the Greco-Roman world, this idea of ecclesia, it was a gathering, an assembly, not just a club, but a group of people who got together for political purposes, to make decisions, to make binding decisions about the community. You see, Jesus wanted and wants his people to be an ecclesia. Not just the people who come together to worship and to study the Bible. That's good, and we should, and we do come together to study the Bible. But a group of people who have each other's backs, who support each other, that when someone is being sinned against, even by members of their own family, we don't say, "Well, good luck with that. We'll pray for you on Sunday. Come back next week." We have each other so that you can bring those problems here to the assembly, to the gathering, to the people, to your family that have your back when other people continually sin against you, because this is real life, isn't it, church? And Jesus knew this was real life. And yes, absolutely, you want to handle it privately, you want to handle it discreetly, but at some point, this may be the reality that you find yourself in. And the church has your back. These are your people. And you should be able to tell this situation to the people. And then Jesus says, if he won't listen even to the assembly, even when the assembly says, "This is what's right, this is what's wrong, you've done what's wrong, this is not okay, you cannot continue to do this," that person should be treated as a Gentile and a tax collector. Now, if you're part of the body of Christ, if you're part of the covenant people of God, that is the absolute worst punishment you could possibly imagine. The worst. For somebody to say, "Wes, you're not part of the covenant people of God. You're like a Gentile to us. You're like a tax collector to us. You're like someone who used to be part of the family, and then you turned your back on the family and you sided with the enemy. That's who you're like to us." That's the worst. But on the other hand, do you remember how Jesus treated Gentiles and tax collectors? He didn't shun them. He recognized that they weren't part of the covenant people, but he pursued reconciliation with them, didn't he? And isn't that what we should be doing? Even when we have to say to someone, because of what you've done, because of your actions, because you've chosen not to be part of the family of God, you've chosen to put yourself outside of God's people, we're going to respect that choice. It's not okay. We don't condone it. We don't affirm it. But you've chosen not to be part of the family of God. But even people who are outside of the family of God, we still love them And we still pursue reconciliation with them. In fact, reconciliation is always the goal. But reconciliation only happens when people recognize the results of their sin. That's true with God, and that's true with each other. This is why we have to have direct, frank, honest conversations with each other, because reconciliation only happens when people recognize the results of their sin. And if we're honest, and we've sinned and we've messed up, we want somebody to tell us, don't we? We want somebody to come and say, Wes, you said this thing, and this thing that you said, you did this thing, and this thing you did, it's driving a wedge between us. If we love that person, we don't want the wedge there. So we say, how can we fix this? It's good and loving to let people know the result of your sin is breaking not only your relationship with God, but your relationship with me. So let's have this conversation. But we have to remember that reconciliation is always the goal. But practically speaking, we make reconciliation impossible or unlikely when we do some things, don't we? And I think that's exactly what Jesus is talking about, what Leviticus is talking about. One of those things that we do that makes reconciliation difficult, impossible, or unlikely is that we shield people from the results of their sin. That's not loving. Sometimes we act like it is, isn't it? We say, well, I don't want them to feel bad. I don't want them to know. And so we shield them from the results of their sin. But reconciliation can't happen until people realize the result of their sin. When their sin is driving a wedge between them and God and them and other people, it's not loving or helpful to them or to the church, to anyone else, to shield them from that truth. So talk with them. Talk with them discreetly. Talk with them privately. Talk with them one-on-one. Talk with them in a way that doesn't slander them, but talk to them. Number two, when we hold grudges or harbor bitterness, we make reconciliation impossible or unlikely. Because we're not pursuing it, are we? When we're harboring bitterness, then every time they mess up, yeah, I knew they were like that. Yeah, that's more the same. That's the way they are. Because we're harboring this hatred, this bitterness in our hearts for them. And we make reconciliation unlikely. Or how about number three, gossip or slander? Again, we couch it in terms of, well, this is just a prayer request. I just need you to pray for my so-and-so. I just need you to pray for them and bless their heart. They just keep doing this thing. But in reality, it's not really a prayer request, is it? Sometimes it's slander because we want to kind of drive a little wedge, cause them a little pain because that's what they've done to us. Or how about this? We make reconciliation unlikely or impossible when we embarrass or humiliate people, or when we finally falsely accuse people. This is why we have to go have a frank conversation with people. If we love them and we love the Lord and we love the church, we have to continually pursue reconciliation. We pursue reconciliation with others. Why? Because God pursued reconciliation with us. In fact, that's what we're trying to do here, isn't it? Pursue reconciliation with others as God pursued reconciliation with us. Because do you know who God's enemies were? Us. And do you know what he did? Well, he didn't gossip about us or slander us. He didn't harbor hatred in his heart for us. He loved the world so much that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him might not perish, but have everlasting life. That's what he did for you, to pursue reconciliation with you. That's what Jesus did for you. And so now we do for others what God has done for us, because he pursued reconciliation with us. We pursue reconciliation with our spouse, reconciliation with our children, reconciliation with our parents, reconciliation with our brothers and sisters. Even if they've become like a Gentile or a tax collector to us, we never stop loving them or wanting reconciliation with them, because that's what God did for you. And maybe this morning, maybe this is your opportunity to be reconciled to God through Jesus by being baptized into Christ. Or maybe this morning, you think about some of the relationships that you have in your life, and you recognize that there's a relationship that I know is not right, and there is something I can do. I can't guarantee what they will do. Jesus doesn't guarantee what they will do. But you are in control of what you do. What could you do to pursue reconciliation with them? Or maybe you need prayers. Maybe you need encouragement. If there's anything that we can do for you this morning, our shepherds would love to pray with you in the prayer room, or you can come forward now as together we sing the song.